Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by, firstly, Mark Christensen. Mark, welcome back. How are you?
I'm just great. Thank you, Mike.
And by a man who got into filmmaking because of today's film, which is Fight Club, John Flowers. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
So are we prepared to break rules one and two and discuss this film?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
So what I'm going to try and do is, as we did with most other films, a quick discussion about the film itself. And I know that this is a film that we could spend the entire show just being Siskel and Ebert on and discussing the film. And then we're going to discuss some of the visual effects. And I think the visual effects are particularly interesting in this film, especially when you frame it in the context of 1999. So I know where John sits. Let me start with Mark. I presume, Mark, you gave this film a thumbs up?
Oh, yeah, this thing. I mean, what was interesting was to dip back into it and see how it survived the test of time a decade later. And, you know, it's been called the first film of the 21st century. And that, you know, that's not totally inaccurate. I think it was a real trendsetter and a landmark David Fincher film.
Yeah, absolutely. And for you, John?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the everything about this film... You know, it's interesting. It was the first film that I saw that caused me to think about everything inside of film and how films are made and just all of the aspects of it, because this film just kind of punches you in the face with the film as a medium to convey information. Everything from the
cigarette burn to everything else. I didn't like that about it at first. Sorry, John, to interrupt your finishing your thought there, but I remember reacting against thinking it was kind of clever in that way at the time. Mike, did you have that reaction at all?
I guess I was initially around the time it came out. I was intrigued by films that were perceived and actually, I guess, viscerally are violent, and yet by the same time have actually low body counts and aren't, you know, sort of films with tons of death and stuff. And I know one review around the time said that there was more death in the first, you know, 5 minutes of Saving Private Ryan than there was in the whole of this film. But there was a New Zealand film that I refer to, which is We Were Warriors, which in a similar way to this film, that was less technically innovative, you know, was sort of psychologically incredibly violent and upsetting, and yet had almost no death and stuff in it. And I think that was an issue that was really obsessing with me at the time, is that how can you make a film that's so violent and yet the violence is nothing compared to a Schwarzenegger film where, you know, hundreds of people are killed per minute.
Right. I was referring to the number of self-conscious movie-making scenes that are in this film, the scenes that really draw your attention to the story being told, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Which I love. I mean, which I think are some of the best things about it. Excuse me, it seems like I have something in my throat. That's what I was talking about.
I guess for me it was the most obvious postmodern film of the Hollywood era that it came from. And that self-referential nature of the discourse was pretty interesting at a number of levels, but it was also a very confident move, I think, on behalf of Fincher. I mean, Fincher today, you know, but after, I guess he'd had Seven under his belt. Let's sort of place this in a timeline. So Seven came out in 95 and obviously had the greatest opening title sequence in history. But a few years before that, he'd done Aliens 3, which, let's face it, was appallingly bad.
Well, I thought it was a meditation on survival. I liked Alien 3.
Yeah, but coming on the... you know, heels of Aliens 2, and I don't know, it just, yeah, it didn't work for me. And he got that role of doing Aliens 3 simply because he, you know, said to Sigourney, let's shave your head and go hardcore. And up until that point, you'd probably say he was best known as a music video director.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So then...
yeah, that's how he made his way up.
We get Seven, which obviously has a huge impact and also stars Brad Pitt. He then does a couple of other films, and then we've got Fight Club in 99. Now, after that, there's...
well, he
Panic
did The
Room
Game in between Seven and Fight Club, which is, I think, true. One of the most underrated films that he's done.
Well, that's true. I just underrated it by not mentioning it. yes, and there were some of the same visual effects team on The Game as there was on this. And then after that, Panic Room and Zodiac. And, of course, now Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which is also starring Brad Pitt. So I guess at this point he had enough confidence to go pretty hardcore, and it is without a doubt a pretty hardcore film. And yet, I'm trying to remember where it sat in relationship to Nights I See Dead People. Because when was that? What was that, that bloody film?
It was around the same time.
Right.
And Matrix. I think all three of them were 99, were they? I'm going to check.
Yeah, and I believe Rushmore was around the same time as well.
Because obviously one of the big things in this film is the huge reveal, and I think we're pretty safe in saying that if you're listening to this show and you've probably seen Fight Club, so we're going to have to discuss the film and give away anything. So if you haven't seen it, turn off now. But if you have seen it, you'll know that obviously a huge point about it is the sort of 9/10 of the way through reveal about his split personality, and that's a both a clever device, but also just confident filmmaking to kind of pull that off. Because there were quite a lot of scenes where, you know, it was completely violating the. If you go back and check, you'll notice that, you know, Tyler never spoke when he was other people around or anything like that. No, that's not the case. It really was Tyler interacting with people, and it was just his perception that it wasn't him. So, to a certain extent, I think the audience was, not given an opportunity to say, "Oh yeah, now I see it. I realize that, you know, the whole thing was a trick." I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, it was based on the book, obviously, by Chuck Palahniuk, and it's really interesting to me that if you look at the book and you look at the movie, they're almost exactly identical with just a few tiny exceptions. One of them is, of course, where Tyler and the person who is the narrator but called Jack in the film, where they meet on an airplane in the movie, but in the book they actually meet on a beach. So it's almost word for word an adaptation of what is just a really phenomenally good novel. The dialogue and everything's basically the same, with just, like, say, a few notable exceptions.
So I
was going to jump in with the point that confidence really radiates right into the effects filmmaking, and that this was a landmark film for Previz. And in reviewing it a little bit, I noticed how many specific details. I mean, this is a film full of just minute details. And it even makes jokes about minute details. I mean, some of the ideas visually in the film are based on minute details, right? And I think to get there took this confidence that apparently Fincher just has, which is relatively rare in directors, to just know what you want and just go right at it. And I think the previous team, I was talking to those guys at PLF at the time, and, you know, that was pretty early use of that extensive pre-visualization.
Yeah, well, let's discuss the visual effects now. Even though it would be fun to talk about the rest of the filming. I mean, apart from the sort of there was some obvious stuff that, you know, clearly was, well, let's start with the opening titles, I guess, that clearly CG throughout. What I didn't pick up, I guess, when I first saw it, and didn't until I was I think there's a limited edition or semi-limited edition DVD dual collector's thing. Collector's discs being just as many as they can possibly sell, but I don't know. I mean, you know, don't get me started on why they call them collector's discs. But anyway, in that, there's a great making of section on the visual effects. And the detained title sequence, something I hadn't understood at the time, is that Kevin Mack, who's since gone on to do things like, I don't know, Speed Racer and a whole lot of stuff, but back then... he described himself as an amateur neurosurgeon and actually tried to make that opening title sequence as medically accurate as possible. And, I mean, I just thought it was cool looking. I mean, what about you guys? It was.
Yeah, he said that he wanted to start in the amygdala because that's the fear center, right, and it would be suitable for this film. I mean, it's also a ride sequence, but they chose the woman who art directed it based on her work on the Visible Human Project, which was going on around the same time.
Yeah, Catherine Jones.
So yeah, they
right.
wanted to be... yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just saying Catherine Jones, right? She was kind of famous at the time as a medical illustrator.
Yeah, exactly right. And so the idea was that they were going to produce this incredibly accurate opening sequence. But I thing that I found amusing was that the initial plan from Fincher was to have people's titles or the titles that came up in that sequence up for only 8 frames as kind of a subliminal right. flash. And, of course, contractual and studio requirements nicked that on the head. But so let's discuss it from a technical point of view, because this is 3D circa literally a decade ago. And that's one of the things I liked about bringing this film up this week, is that we are, you know, at the cusp of its 10-year anniversary. So how did we think it held up in terms of computer graphics, given that it was 10 years old?
Well, I mean, there are things that are obviously look dated, you know, if you want to be critical of it. But there's not much that really pulls you out of this movie. So, and I mean, Mike, I think you can probably speak best to some of the trends that started and whether they've continued. I mean, photogrammetry, you know, was used extensively in a way that I don't know. I mean, have movies made such extensive use of photogrammetry since?
Well, actually, it's an interesting point you bring up. The photogrammetry aspects of it is one of the things I think has progressed incredibly solidly. Because if you think about it, I already mentioned Kevin Mack, one of the visual effects supervisors at DD. He went right through to Speed Racer. If you think about it, a lot of the HDR image-based modeling and stuff like that actually extends right through to the entire sort of Speed Racer approach of virtual environments and stuff. And that was also
that's a really good point.
I think it was also used extensively in Vanilla Sky, another film that he worked on in 2001, which was a couple of years after this. So I think that there's no question in my mind that that the photogrammetry has been a relevant move forward. I thought the only stuff that took me out of the film was the CG. I didn't mind the opening title sequence because I can accept that being fairly stylized, but the galaxy of trash that, for example, Boof did, which was the shot out of the garbage bin. Now, that was probably your best example of how technology shifted in the 10 years since, because that was going to be, you know, done with photogrammetry. They ended up having to do it as just full 3D, and they rendered it with a radiosity solution, and that radiosity solution ended up as about 8 hours a frame. So it's, you know, right, almost a day a frame. 3 weeks to render out the trash sequence. Now, at the
right
time,
and then Fincher asked for a second pass. He's like, well, okay, that was good first try. Now can we change it? So then they told him once.
Yeah, exactly. So the nature of radiosity back then was sort of a radiant solution based on diffuse surface. So it didn't terribly well pick up spec highlights, certainly didn't do caustics and that kind of stuff. The radiosity algorithms that they were using at Boof were pretty much revolutionary at the time. And yet, looking at that sequence today, it just doesn't, to me, hold up as being good CG. I would see that as being CG that wasn't a final. If it was shown in a film
today.
Well,
I mean, the stove sequence, which relied on both, you know, same thing. I mean, you do notice the lack of particularly spec highlights. It's a really good thing to pick up on there.
Yeah, it's,
and you're right.
Yeah, the advances in radiosity, because the idea, when you sort of go technical for a second, the idea on the radiosity algorithms is that every surface produces a non-light source for force in the light equation. And I say force in the light equation because it's doing stuff to your lighting equation based on a whole bunch of stuff, which you'd expect to happen in real life because it's bounce light, but makes it pretty darn complicated to do in CG because every object effectively becomes a light source. It's not actually projecting light, but it's bouncing light and influencing it. And the classic case is, you know, a big green wall, you know, objects, that, especially their shadows near that green wall, will be tinted green. Now, at the stage we are at with radiosity when they did this at Boof, the solution pretty much fell on a solution that worked best for diffuse surfaces, and you can't make every point of every surface a light source. If you think about it for a second, I mean, it's one thing to say every object is a light source, and you kind of conceptually think, oh, there's a wall and that's a light source. But you'd actually have to make every point on the wall a light source to sort of truly model it. And so you end up with this sort of sensible way of averaging out stuff so that you get, you know, some result inside of this century. And that that didn't work at all with caustics, so you couldn't really do stuff that was refracted through or reflected up from, say, glass or stuff. So if you watch the trash sequence, most of those surfaces are, admittedly, they're shaded, but they're sort of diffuse-based surfaces. Now, in the real trash scenario that they pulled out, everything was a reflective, glass, shiny kind of object. And that jump is something that's only happened in the last few years. And in fact, the latest of those advances that, you know, probably we're going to see in something like, well, the next generation of film is stuff to do with transmissive media as we start to get radiosity solutions that take into account fog and atmospheric fall off due to light scattering. So there's a continuum there, and this is at the beginning of it. It looked good at the time. I just think that it's, you know, one of the few places that it's showing its age. Now, take nothing away from what the guys did at the time. It's just, you know, when they did the car crash, when they did the gunshot, for example, which I think is particularly good, even the ice cage, the ice cave with Blue Sky's work on the penguin, I felt all of that held up pretty well. It was just when they went to the full CG elements.
Well, yeah, and if you look at the final scene, you know, where the all the office buildings were destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. That was something that was done by Richard Bailey, who's at Image Savant. And Image Savant is really interesting because it's this kind of custom software. I mean, it's also a post-production house, but it's a custom software package that is used for a lot of very strange... it was in What Dreams May Come and other things, but it's a kind of a strange way of blending light in a kind of hyper-real way. And a lot of the opening image sequence was that. But anyway, Richard Bailey spent 14 months on that final explosion office building sequence, which is interesting, right? Because that's the same kind of time frame that Fincher spent on Zodiac with the... building.
The Transamerica building,
exactly.
Well, that was, I think that was basically one or two guys who had to do that Transamerica building, right?
Yeah, and it was one guy who did that credit card building, credit card office building destruction, just based on...
Doc Bailey.
Richard Bailey, mm-hmm. Yeah. Doc Bailey.
So, doesn't he go by Doc?
I don't like to call him Doc. Remember, well, kids, he's not a real doctor.
I would say that the building collapse doesn't hold up very well. And it's an iconic moment in the film. Well, you know, looking at it, it's based on a lot of shattering. And they shot a little bit of practical stuff to get, I think the initial detonations were practical. And then everything else, you know, yeah, photographically, it's really cool. Like the Translight that you're talking about was as much as I understand about it, it was a big step forward in terms of how it was shaded. But the animation and destruction of it... you know, not to be tasteless, but we've seen a lot of buildings go down since then. And so they look like they shatter, like there's just mostly glass.
Oh, and I got the impression, I guess for me it was a little bit different, because I got the impression that it was meant to be hyper real, almost like a parody of a cartoon. It was meant to be such an extreme perspective on the destruction of the buildings around them that's how they wanted it to look. I didn't get the impression that they were trying to make it perfectly real. It was this brittle infrastructure that was being destroyed, and therefore, by definition, it would look like glass.
I must admit, I thought that had they done that with miniatures, it would have looked better. And so, while I hadn't thought about it until you said that, John, maybe you're absolutely right. I guess I just assumed that they picked not exactly the perfect solution in going with it CG. If that had been a miniatures destruction, we would have had a much more realistic collapse of the buildings. I think that we should just explain how that was set up. So we're talking about the actors standing in front of black by the time the buildings go.
And wearing black.
And wearing black, yeah, which is a roto nightmare. And then they were actually firing off light bulbs and flashes from the other side of the theoretical window, so it would light up the actors and the room that they were standing in sync with what was going to be happening with the CG. So if the CG caused an explosion to happen 3 seconds into the shot, then 3 seconds into the shot, a flash happened on the practical stage. And then they melded those two together. Now, the practical elements that were shot were things like, you know, on blacked miniature buildings, so the buildings themselves weren't there. There was sort of a blowout of white, you know, smoke or whatever, and then that would be comped, that white smoke, into a set of windows on the CG buildings. And the brittle stuff that you're referring to, John, is on, especially on the right, where the buildings really did, the concrete kind of shatters in an almost glass or mosaic kind of shattering kind of way. And it's less successful today, though. If you go for the hyper real thing that you're talking about, then I guess you could say it was artistically valid. I don't think it was didn't stand out as badly to me as the stuff in the wastebasket, but it's a big ask. I mean, back in 1999, it was a big ask to bring down multiple buildings. Plus, I think the other thing was, most of us, how can I put this delicately, visual effects artists now have unfortunately got extraordinary reference, and the audience is very visually literate of what a building coming down looks like. That was something that we weren't familiar with back then. So it was almost like a less critical eye, because today you'd have to bring down a building in a fashion that the public is familiar with from 9/11, because that's so burnt into everybody's consciousness because it was such a significant event. So, but let's try and be positive for a second. What do we think was some of the best visual effects, and what stood up the best?
I think the sex scene is astonishing. I thought so at the time, and I still think it's just amazing. It's amazing looking. It was amazingly shot. It's really, you know, it's quite beautiful. But the fact that they pulled it off, you know, they were given a really difficult brief, which was to do what had to be kind of a CG move around real humans, and not only that, starring actors of the film. And I think when, you know, they did an extensive R&D effort, from what I was able to glean researching this, and you can probably speak more to this, but, you know, they basically looked at various ways to model skin and hair and so on for 99, which would have been a nightmare, and didn't have the money or the budget or the time to do it that way. And so they came up with this other way of doing it, which I think was project, you know, it was sort of Matrix style photo array and projecting those onto these complex 3D models. Can you say more about it, Mike?
Well, the way that the brief was defined to the VFX team, they wanted them to have the properties of giant statues. So they wanted them to have a height sense, if that makes sense. You wanted them to be seen to be big and tall, like towering statues. And so that introduced one huge aspect to the shot, which is depth of field, because and motion blur and stuff as a variable. The second thing they wanted, obviously, was this kind of, as you said, very CG kind of swing around moves with frozen moments. And that was in this environment where, as you say, well, you didn't really have the kind of subsurface scattering that we have today. Like, subsurface scattering was just being introduced around that time, and it was still at sort of R&D level. And it was certainly not at the level it is today, where we have, you know, multiple layers of subsurface scattering on our algorithms for doing skin, and hair was, you know, not anywhere near what it is today. So you're right, they did use five cameras, and Boof did that one with five cameras and body doubles for the actors. So there were face mappings going on, there were body doubles, and then they interpolated between five sets of stills, which were allowing them to effectively swing around the environment. And then, of course, they added back in some elements like some smoke and some movement and blurs and stuff. But I couldn't agree with you more, Mark, that was, I think, one of the most artistically strong moments of the film. It worked thematically, it worked visually, and technically, the second I saw it, I was like, both then and even again today, re-seeing it, it was like, you know, this is a cool technique, and how'd they do that kind of thing. And I think using photogrammetry there was about the only way they could have got it pulled off. But it didn't feel even as if, even though it was an odd sequence in the sense that, you know, obviously it's a dream, so it was not meant to be a sort of photo natural thing, it didn't feel stuck in, and it didn't feel like, oh, we don't have enough resolution to pull this off properly. I thought it was an astonishing feat. What do you think, John?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny you talk about that. That, to me, it was simultaneously, you know, disturbing, but it was also, visually, it was the most impressive thing I'd seen. And it once again, it was one aspect of the film that made me take a step back and just ask myself, how in the world did they accomplish that? And it really caused me to think about all of the different layers that go into filmmaking, which I hadn't viscerally really absorbed before that. And it just, yeah, unbelievable.
Let's talk about the gunshot at the end, because that was another sequence that I thought was superb. Mark, did you have, you know, did you think it stood up, the gunshot in the mouth?
Oh, yeah, it works great. And I mean, again, looking into the behind the scenes stuff and finding out that, you know, they had to try, well, I don't know, a couple different approaches before they got to the way they did it, which was astonishingly practical and uncomfortable for the actor. But yeah, it's awesome. That shot is great. And certainly we've seen a lot of shots that have, you know, built on from that basic idea, but that one, I think it stands up.
Let's just walk people through how they did it, because it's a point in the film where it's so dramatic you may be not actually looking at the visual effects surrounding it, and there is a particularly good making of section of it in the on the special DVD. But they built a, like, effectively a life cast of the actor, then they built from there a effectively what I'm going to call a rubber head, which they could shoot stuff at. And that was some of the work that, you know, tried to understand how the gun nozzle high discharge of air would cause the cheeks on the actor to really balloon up before the bullet obviously pierced through the head, sorry to be gory. And ironically, what they ended up doing, as you said, in the second approach, was getting an air nozzle and actually aiming it at the actor's mouth and firing it, to a point that somebody joked that, you know, they'd gone much more, they'd actually done in physical damage. And you imagine 180 pounds per square inch fired in your mouth just to give the illusion of a gun going off. I mean, it's actually, you know, right down your throat. It's quite painful. But that was all filmed, again, this time with five Panavision cameras, which was interesting, actually, because before we were talking about the sex scene, that was done with stills. This was actually done with Panavision cameras. And I kept on thinking, as I was looking at this again, that in so many of these instances, in this, in the Translight, in some of the CG work, all this photography we keep on referring to wasn't digital photography. This was, you know, film photography. When they wanted to get high-rise pictures, they got 8x10, you know, actual bits of neg. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, it was all sort of photographic, which we kind of take for granted now how much easier it is to do with digital stills and digital cameras. But anyway, they got those five Panavision cameras and filmed his head and his sort of jerking back of his head in real time, and then comped on elements, including dropping a bolt into a bunch of... You guys ever, I mean, I'm sure you have, had McDonald's thick shakes. You'll know that there's, you know, this ridiculously thick stuff that they, or rather stuff they add to it to thicken it up. And this is a favorite from volcanic lava flows to, in this case, blood. If you put methacil in, like, liquid and get it looking rich and thick and globby, you can drop, in their case, they dropped a bolt in and got a nice, lovely sort of gloopy kind of blood splat coming out. And they comped that coming out of his mouth. But it was interesting because in that commentary when they were talking about it, they were saying that they calculated the shot as being equivalent to shooting 360 frames a second. But again, one of those points where Fincher went off script, he just decided to have the bullet visible and stuff and moving around in shot because he just wanted to see it, even though, of course, you wouldn't see a bullet even at 360 frames a second. I guess
it wouldn't bounce off the jaw and come back out the mouth.
But it was just a cracker of a shot because you don't really... I mean, apart from anything else, you don't really expect the actor to shoot himself in the head. And quite frankly, it was a pretty severe close-up when he did it. And it was... I found it genuinely interesting and shocking at the same time. John, your thoughts?
Well, I don't have much to add to that. I mean, it was a cracker. It was... totally one of the single most disturbing things that were committed to film in my mind, because like you said, it was really close. You literally see the jawbone break as the bullet comes out. It just when he's, you know, at the aftermath when he's holding his face is disturbing. Everything about it just sort of screamed out to you, don't ever do this. Don't ever see this again. This is gonna, you know, it's imprint into your limbic region. You're not gonna be able to get away from it. And it holds up. It holds up. I mean, I think that's the thing Mark was saying is you can look at it now, even today, and say it would be a believable shot in a film, you know, in 2008.
So, John, I want to put you on the spot here about something else. Obviously, with your passion over at Life Zero, there are sort of issues of consumerism in this film that you tackled yourself independently in your own podcast. But I want to ask you, tying in, I guess, into the IKEA porn, somebody made a reference that Fincher has a lot of TVCs or fake TVCs in his work. You probably know Fincher's work pretty well because I know you admire his work. Is he still doing that? Is he still putting fake commercials in? And what did you think of the IKEA porn sequence?
I thought the IKEA porn sequence was really well done. I know that it kind of mirrors one of the movies that you like, which is Stranger Than Fiction, in the way that it's laid out, certainly. I mean, would you make a connection there between the Stranger Than Fiction?
I hadn't until you said it. You're absolutely right. That's absolutely the case. There are graphics sitting in the shot which are sort of serving the story, and the character is oblivious to. But they seem to sit right in there with the actor. Actually, interesting on those graphics on the IKEA one, they actually had to do wide angle lens distortion on the graphics so that they didn't just sit in there and track. They sat in there, tracked, and warped with the lens. But I thought it was a really interesting plot point because the graphics, you know, really weren't a device at that point. There really was a whole sense of, I mean, that was a really big kind of consumerism moment we had to set up at the beginning of the film, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was really funny. I mean, it was a joke we hadn't really seen that joke before, right? See the catalog come to life in that way.
Does anyone know if Fincher's still doing?
Definitely is. You know, in Zodiac, there was a scene where the Zodiac letters have gone to the Chronicle office, and the actual handwritten letters are floating on 3D planes around the office, and it sort of shows the obsession that the book author who works at the Chronicle has for the Zodiac Killer. So he's still doing these things where he puts these really stylized motion graphic elements right into a naturalistic scene, and it's something I really like of Fincher's style.
Because John, I think you'd agree that it was an interesting way to deal with the consumerism, right? Because there are like many ways, and as Mark said, we hadn't seen this one before, but that was a really breathtakingly good way of doing that plot point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it brought it home full force, and I think we're all responsible for at some point looking at a catalog like that and calling it porn. You know, whether it's the B&H photo catalog, which just came in recently, or you know, the Imaudio catalog, or what have you. We all sort of get that catalog, and it is all of the stuff that we just sort of in our heads imagine and create, you know, create in our orbit. Oh, I want this and that and this. And it was sort of disturbing, really, to watch it come alive like that.
There were a lot of really good quotes around that time. But I remember hearing them saying, when I was watching it again, it was like, things you own that end up owning you. And I thought that could have been a line straight out of one of your podcasts.
Yeah, it does seem like that a little bit. I mean, when I read the book, that really resonated with me as well. It's like, be careful, the things you own don't end up owning you. I mean, the first, you know, rule of life zero is really only what you need, right? What you need and no more. And so I guess in a way this did kind of resonate with me. Kind of called me out on that, Mike. Nice.
So now one of the last things that we haven't discussed, which we just should, because I think it's a cracker, is the
plane crash.
Yeah, the plane crash. Exactly right. Yeah. Mark, do you want to talk us about that sequence?
Well, I mean, it's the kind of sequence that I think would still be really satisfying to pull off because it involves so many different things that they had to do with it. And it's the one, I mean, they in the behind-the-scenes stuff, they show the previs of that one a lot. It was a really complicated one to plan out. I don't know if I can give it full justice, Mike, but I mean, I thought what was funny was the one thing they said they would change about it was that Fincher insisted on shooting it at 60 FPS, and had they done it at 360, you would have been able to see all of the flying Smirnoff bottles and all the other things that they actually carefully made sure to get in there. But a lot of the stuff they put in there that really worked, like Fincher's favorite thing was the oxygen masks. And those were practical. He just, you know, they just shot some oxygen masks and stuck them in there. But, you know, it's a really good example of kind of going off being totally realistic. And it's where I think the style of the movie just shows through a lot. Like, it's sick and funny and horrifying. And it goes on for a long time because it's in slow-mo. And they even got one of the effects supervisors to have a prominent cameo at the end.
Yeah, it's funny that Kevin Haag, who's the visual effects supervisor, and now actually he's just doing Quantum of Solace, the new James Bond film. And the other one, which we referred to earlier, Kevin Mack, the other Kevin, was, as I said, you know, he won the Oscar for What Dreams May Come and has just done Speed Racer. But you're right, he's sitting in a chair at the end of that sequence, and actually in one of the takes, actually had his glasses broken by a prop that hit him so hard in the face during the sequence. But if we just talk about the actual sort of technical pulling it off section, I mean, if I saw that on a piece of paper, well, two things. Firstly, as with so many effects in this film, and we mentioned this earlier, it's an enormous amount of budget to send on one shot, and there's no other payoff. You know, it's not like you've got the plane breaking apart sequences, the opening shot of the whole film that's the establishing shot. You know, there are a lot of sequences like the gunshot or the plane or whatever it is that, you know, it's just like a one-off effect. It's not like you get 20 shots out of this. It's not like you build a lot of assets and you get to reuse them again and again and again. I mean, the rest of the plane stuff, when he's just talking about condiments, is going to be practically done in a real set with just a real plane, because there's not even a window replacement on those. So it's great. It's great to see someone devote budget to shots where it's just that shot. I mean, the sex scene, right? Those techniques only used in that shot. And so even today, if I was looking at that shot, I'd think, well, my hell, it's a hell of a lot of effort to go into for this.
And that's Fincher. I mean, that, and you know, Zodiac, going back to that film, Zodiac is essentially a cop drama that turned into a David Fincher film because of all those kind of touches that are added into it and all the completely unnecessary extra detail. I mean, unnecessary other than for those of us who totally love it and end up thinking of it as what we remember about the film in many ways.
I also thought it was interesting that they shot that plane sequence on an 18mm lens. It's a very wide-angle shot kind of coming round, and it, you know, it would have been easy to play a plane crash with sort of like a longer lens with, you know, things falling and clutter and crashes and shakes and stuff. And that was kind of like a pan around, watch the plane disintegrate, which it needed to be because it was his point of view kind of experiencing this in a dream. But it was just so well executed. And as you say, for 1999, 10 years ago, you know, it's pretty humbling to see a shot like that, a single shot where you obviously don't have a vast amount of budget because it's not the, you know, principal establishing shot. And it, I just, you know, I wouldn't have actually faulted it. I don't know if I was reviewing that. I mean, what about you guys? If you were reviewing that shot, would you have notes on it today?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm looping it up right now. And I mean, you know, there's little things that you have to forgive because of the time it was done. I mean, it's like, well, the motion blur and the animation on that guy sitting in the chair that goes flying out the side. It's like, well, I'm not convinced by that.
Right. That, felt, okay. That felt a that little minor. Janky, yeah.
So, I mean, it's really, I mean, it's stuff that would definitely come up in dailies on take, you know, 10 or 12. But, I mean, come on. No, it's, I mean, and it's impressive, too, because I think to do this shot now, there still wouldn't be a one-button approach to getting this thing right. I mean, it would still be a mixture of really carefully planned live action, a lot of gnarly compositing, and CG.
I guess if I was to sum up this film as we've sort of been hinting at, for me personally, and I'll get your opinions each in a second, it's Fincher loves the film, loves the filmmaking process, and kind of loves the audience. Like, what I like about it is that there seems to be a genuine, I'm going to give you something I don't need to give you, because it's not just because it's cool and it looks kind of funky, but it's because I'm going to take the time to craft this for you. And it's almost the exact reverse of taking the audience for granted or being patronizing. It's almost like, I accept that you're visually literate and intelligent, and I'm going to give you these extra things as kind of a gift to make the experience rich, but not to take you out of the film. Mark, your summary?
Yeah, you picking up on that, I mean, I don't know of another director who, I mean, there are other directors with signature visual styles, but, you know, Fincher's in a unique position to do that. He's got the budgets to do it, and he makes good relationships with the people who get those shots done for him, I sense.
And John, in a world full of condiments, what did you think of this film?
I thought that something sort of apt was, there's a scene in Fight Club where the narrator, who's called Jack in the film, just beats the living hell out of someone. And Tyler says to him, "Where did you go, psycho boy?" And Jack says, "I felt like destroying something beautiful." And to me, in a lot of ways, that is kind of the way that Fincher looked at this film and approached it. Everything from the color correction process, where he just threw the contrast out and you know, dropped the exposure and did all of this weird stuff to make it ugly. You know, Fincher did so much to take all
well,
of this...
Weird for the time, right?
Yeah.
Trendsetting as well, yeah.
It took all this stuff to just make something that would have otherwise been such a beautiful shot, to just make it ugly, to give you the, you know, the sense of what you were really looking at. And I mean, that's it to me. It's like, it just, you know, it exposes the real sort of the real sort of surface, you know, all the way from the hair follicle at the beginning to the explosions at the end, just the surface of grit, you know. And I don't know, I just love every aspect of it. You know, it's interesting, David Orr, the guy who did the color work, went on to do like The Last Samurai, Superman Returns, and he was the color timer in The Dark Knight. And you can really see that, you know what I mean? You can really see that trajectory from where Fight Club set the pace, and then after that it was just this look that everyone started adopting.
Chew on those blacks.
Yeah, like it's okay, yeah, right?
That bluey-green, heavily contrast look really defined it for a generation, didn't it? I mean, it was like the look for commercials after this film came out.
Yeah, and...
Well, this one, The Matrix was in there, you know, same time. Even, I mean, Sixth Sense, well, not
yeah,
quite
and,
the same.
And
yeah,
and Nakamura, who worked on the color in this one, also worked on the color in Matrix.
So just in finishing up, if you want to thank our producers, John...
Sure, yeah. I would like to thank Kevin Hansen, who does a lot of work behind the scenes, and he's diligently working at the Pixelcor office, and Lori Apthorpe and Kristen Martin, who does just a tremendous amount of work on sound and makes this whole thing possible for us.
And we want to thank you guys for being with us. Where can people find you, John? What's the best? I definitely suggest, if you're interested to the themes of Fight Club, that people check out John's work on Life Zero. Where can they find you, John?
You can find a collection of my own ramblings at lifezero.org, and it includes links to the Life Zero podcast and the That Media Show.
And Mark?
I have been Twittering occasionally as Flow Seeker, and I have a new book edition in the works.
When's that coming out?
As well as my PhD class. That's, you know, all kinds of things going on.
When's your book
when's it coming out? Adobe has a rather sizable announcement planned. I don't know when it'll time out relative to this show, but probably shortly after. And we'll hit it as close as we can. It's not going to be, you know, day and date, but...
Well, you can find me over at FX Guide and on Twitter at Mike Seymour. And if this is your first VFX show, then you have to fight. I just want to leave you with the immortal words that I'm certainly going to be taking on board as soon as we hang up from this podcast, which is that I'm off to get my Grand Latte enema. Thanks, guys, and I'll see you next week.
Nice.